Donc c'est la dernière séance ce matin sur la situation dans différents pays. À partir de cet après-midi, on parlera plus du cas de la France. Alors je suis très heureuse et très honorée d'être présidente de cette table parce que nous allons entendre tout de suite des personnes références clés pour toutes celles et ceux qui travaillent en sciences sociales sur la GPA. À commencer par Sharmila Rudrapa, donc, qui a fait un terrain en Inde à Bangalore et qui est auteur du livre Discounted Life. Voilà, je te passe la parole, Sharmila.
Thank you, Virginie, for inviting me, and thank you everyone for being here for my talk. The title of my talk is What Difference Does Money Make? Surrogate Mothers in Bangalore, Southern India. My talk has changed a little bit. What I want to do today is certainly build from my book that just got published. But I also want to talk about the ban on commercial surrogacy in India, but which we will then, India will be allowing altruistic surrogacy. So I would really like to talk about those kinds of implications, which then actually at some level ties to my title, What Difference Does Money Make? A little bit of a timeline to legal developments regarding surrogacy in India. As we've all heard from the various presentations so far, commercial surrogacy was legalized in 2002. It certainly was driven by various doctors. There was no real demand for it, but really perhaps, you know, an interest in increasing trade, perhaps. Though there were regulations, they were not necessarily enforced. Much of my book really is about surrogacy from around 2008 to 2012, and the book comes out. So I really miss in my research the ban that happens for gay couples in 2012 and also single parents from using surrogacy services in India. And what we know is as of August 24th, 2016, a new surrogacy bill was actually passed by the government, which is potentially going to become law, that bans commercial surrogacy altogether, but allows altruistic surrogacy. And so that is what I'd really like to talk about. And at some level, if you wanted to think about a takeaway point from my talk, if you wanted to summarize it, it would be why altruism is bad for women. Okay, so my book titled Discounted Life, The Price of Global Surrogacy in India, just got published by NYU Press. And the main themes in the book are really two large questions. How do labor markets in surrogate mothers emerge? And I sort of look at the long histories of reproductive interventions, mainly population control, that has existed in India. So that is one part of the book. And I also look at the labor histories of the surrogate mothers in Bangalore. Most of them tended to be garment workers, and they were really recruited from sweatshops where they produced garments for a global market. Also internal consumption, but a global market. The second large question that I have in the book is how do clients and surrogate mothers negotiate the commodification of pregnancy? I want to speak a little bit about that because I think that has relevance for my larger question that I ask on altruism. The fieldwork, as I said, the book is based on fieldwork from 2008 to early 2012. It's mostly conducted in Bangalore, southern India, where I grew up, but I don't live anymore, but my family does live there, parents, cousins, so on and so forth. I did participant observation in infertility clinic for a summer. I interviewed eventually 70 surrogate mothers, 31 egg donors, and also I need to add that some of the surrogate mothers are egg donors as well, which is not included in the 31. 20 clients, and I call them clients because that is what the surrogate mothers and also the doctors in India call them, both gay and straight couples in the US and Australia. Some of this was through Skype, and actually some of this was through visiting with them at homes. Focus groups with garment workers, because so many surrogate mothers were garment workers. And then ongoing conversations, even till today, with infertility doctors and lawyers in Bangalore and Hyderabad, both southern cities. Now, one of the main points, as I said, you know, in the question, how do surrogate mothers and clients negotiate commodification of pregnancy? I guess it's at some level an age-old anthropological question in thinking about these new forms of, I guess you can't call it labor as yet, but new forms of life processes that are getting absorbed into the market, right? Commodification that is proceeding. Here are these agents trying to figure out what exactly does this exchange mean. So much of the book is really documenting how people are trying to make sense of this exchange. And basically, if you think about, if I think through my data, there are two ways by which people are talking about surrogacy, right? Surrogacy as a gift exchange and surrogacy as commodity. Now, most of the intended parents, clients that I spoke with talked about surrogacy as a gift. Repeatedly, they talked about what an amazing thing the surrogate mother had done for them. She had given them a gift of life, bigger than life itself. She changed their lives for the better. It was an amazing gift that she'd given them. But on the other hand, gift relationships are really attended to by ongoing relationships between giver and receiver, right? So when you give someone a gift, there's also an exchange that comes back in return. It really, in a gift relationship, there's an ongoing social relationship. Instead, what we see is that most intended parents, I'm not going to say all, there were about three parents, intended parents, who maintained and kept maintaining ties. Most intended parents, even though they talked about this as an incredible gift, did not keep ongoing social relationships with the surrogate mothers. The interesting thing, on the other hand, was the surrogate mothers talked about this really as a labor process, about money, why they need to get more than the $4,000 that they received for each pregnancy. That's how much they got in Bangalore as of 2011. Yet on the other hand, even though they spoke about this as a labor process for which they needed wages, they really wanted to maintain an ongoing relationship between themselves and the families that they'd given the babies to. So then the question is, what's going on? I'm going to basically focus on the gift relationship aspect because I want to think about altruism and surrogate mothers. And in the Q&A, we can certainly talk about the intended parents as well. What is interesting is that, at least in my research, I found that, you know, in a city like Bangalore, it's an incredibly expensive city to live in, money disappears. $4,000 is gone within a year. You know, people think that it is a lot of money. Even the surrogate mothers initially think it's a good sum of money. Rent is incredibly expensive. The parents want private schools for their children. There are debts to pay off. When someone is poor or is working class, their family networks as well are equally in a difficult situation. So there's far more demands on their money, and they're very generous with their money, because when your brother says he has a loan, you're not going to look to him and say, let the money lender do what he needs to do to you. You help your family out. So for a poorer family, a working class family, money tends to disappear much faster. And the women understand that more than money, it is networks that matter more. And so surrogacy then allows them at some level to try establish networks that are incredibly important, because these are connections with privileged people across social strata that can provide social benefits, right? Short-term loans, interest-free loans, potential for jobs, right? So it is really networks that matter, that really a lump sum of money. And so then an interest in maintaining a gift relationship is really to maintain an ongoing social relationship that can help you navigate a very precarious urban third world life, right? So this is where we see that. Now let me shift very quickly to what's going on today. I want to talk about the new surrogacy bill. As we know, and as I said earlier, 2016, this year, August, the Indian government more or less bans altruistic commercial surrogacy and allows altruistic surrogacy alone. Now, what is interesting is women are still expected to give birth to babies, but they're going to not receive any compensation for their labor. they're going to be doing this work for free, right? Reproductive exchanges are allowed only for Indian heterosexual couples married for more than 5 years and have medical reasons for childlessness. Now, I understand the medical reasons for childlessness. That makes sense. However, if the wife is childless and the husband has had children through another union, through a previous partner, the couple becomes ineligible for surrogacy because he has children. And therefore, why do they need children? The surrogate mother must be a close relative of the couple, married, and given birth to a healthy child prior to surrogacy. I think this is a big problem because from what we know, I'll just give you the example of myself. I have about 300 relatives in India. These are large kinship networks, you know, where there's ongoing social relationships. Everyone is a cousin. Everyone becomes an aunt. So if I'm going to then say that I, as an intended parent, is going to use kinship networks, there are a lot of relatives who might have lower socioeconomic backgrounds that I can ask to be altruistic towards me, right? But also the understanding that the Indian government has today is exploitation can't happen within kinship networks. It's only commercialization that exploitation happens, but within families, within kinship, it's also hunky-dory and everyone is so appreciative of each other. We don't exploit each other, right? That's a problem. The good part in this new law is that she can be a surrogate mother only once in a lifetime, and I think that is, and I can talk about why that is good, but the problem is there is absolutely no legal protection whatsoever for the surrogate mother. She is completely at the behest now of the the intended parents, who are now perhaps going to say, you've been working as a maid for us for so many years. We've put your children through school. We provided your husband a job. We've given you interest-free loans. Won't you please gift us with the child, right? You can see us suffering. Can't you at least do this much for us, right? So there's ways by which I think this notion of kinship is deeply problematic. And what we at least know from the kidney transplants that are going on in India, where they were so worried about the sale of kidneys, now India, you're only allowed to get kidneys through relatives or someone is feeling altruistic towards you, and there's a board that does sort of the registration of these kinds of things, right? Which is why I was saying anyone can be your relative at some level. So I think that's a problem as well. You can see similar kinds of things that are happening. What I would argue that at some level is that this new surrogacy bill that allows only altruistic surrogacy further deregulates surrogacy. If the government was actually really interested in protecting women, which is what they said they passed this law for, they would have deepened protections. And how would they deepen protections? They would actually recognize surrogacy as a recognizable form of exchange. They would provide better protection for women in the sense that women would have greater reproductive choice in terms of how to get pregnant, whether it's traditionally or whether it's through implantations. They would allow for any kinds of method of giving birth because at present, it's usually, or at least in the previous law, it was all through cesarean surgeries. So if the government was really, really interested, they would have deepened protections rather than deregulating it by providing altruistic surrogacy. I just have one more minute, I would imagine. I'll wrap up. What we know from the evidence from the ban on gay couples, and this is the 2012 law that comes down the pipeline for us, what I have observed is that women tend to get treated like cargo containers that carry goods across national boundaries. Sort of, you know, polemic language, but that is how it starts feeling, precisely because of these kinds of bans that are going on. What we know, for example, is Indian surrogate mothers were hired for gay couples in Delhi, or rather the mothers came from Delhi, but were moved to Nepal once they were implanted with embryos so they could give birth to children in Nepal, where the gay parents could come pick them up, right? This actually decreases the kind of protection that women are actually able to receive, and it makes them incredibly vulnerable, I think. The other thing I've also heard in a visit that I did in a Bombay clinic last September, is that this doctor was starting to bring surrogate mothers from Kenya, impregnated with embryos that belonged to gay couples from various parts of the world. And he kept them in Bombay for 24 weeks and then sent them back to Nairobi where they would actually deliver the babies that then could be picked up. And I would predict at some level that the kind of ban that we're starting to see in India is actually going to ratchet up these kinds of processes where women are literally going to become cargo containers. So this is what altruism is going to do. It actually deepens exploitation. Anyway, that was, I guess, my very brief talk, and I've gone over time. Sorry, Virginie.
Merci Charmila. Maintenant, nous allons écouter Elie Temann, qui est l'auteur de Birthing a Mother, que vous avez certainement lu ou dont vous, que vous connaissez, et qui va nous parler donc de son travail en Israël.
First of all, thank you. That was an amazing presentation, and thank you, Virginie, for inviting me to speak today on this marvelous conference. So we've heard from speakers yesterday and today about how surrogacy takes place in very unregulated contexts and the effects that might have. And yesterday, Daphna told us about surrogacy in Israel, which is the opposite. It's the most highly regulated, tightly controlled, nationally bounded type of surrogacy that I know of. And so what I'd like to talk about today is about the experiences of Israeli surrogates and intended parents within this type of nationally bound surrogacy. So all the women who I'm going to talk about today are all Jewish, because Israel doesn't allow interreligious surrogacies, and they're all Israeli citizens because it does not allow Israeli surrogacy with transnational surrogates or couples. And all of the people who I spoke with about surrogacy went through a surrogacy committee, which is appointed by the state of Israel, which regulates each and every contract. And that means that every contract is not just legal, but it's been looked at by lawyers and from each side, and it's been debated by a panel of 9 people. And so this is the state of Israel actually giving a stamp on each contract and saying, this baby that's born through surrogacy is a citizen and even a kosher Jew, which is something that I'd talk about later, but it's a whole nother story. So my talk today is based on ethnographic research I did from 1998 till 2006, and then another round of 20 interviews with Israeli surrogates this past summer, because I saw something had changed in Israel, that the committee suddenly started allowing married women to become surrogates 2 years ago. And so I wanted to see what that meant for the surrogacy experience. But as most anthropologists will sympathize with, I never really left the field. So here we have a picture of me when my 11-year-old son was born and a family created through surrogacy who attended the bris, the circumcision ceremony of my child. Here's the little girl who was born through surrogacy, and I followed her surrogate and her intended parents through the process from the 5th month of pregnancy. Here she is. I can't even remember how old she was, maybe 3 years old. She's so beautiful. And here she is, 3 years ago, at the wedding of her surrogate, as me and her family watched her walk the surrogate down the aisle. She's just had a bat mitzvah, and the surrogate put pictures all over her Facebook of her with the little girl. So over the years, I've been lucky enough to see what happens with these families over time, and that's also something I could talk about later. What I'd like to suggest here today is that the structure of surrogacy in Israel as this nationally bound phenomenon under a restrictive law results in very intense, intimate relationships between surrogates and intended mothers. And since Israel is such a tiny country, They don't really have to go more than 4 hours drive to see each other, and usually they're about an hour or 2 hours away from each other. So this makes it different than in U.S. surrogacies, where a surrogate might be in California and a couple might be in New York, or transnational surrogacies, of course. These surrogates were accompanied to almost to every medical appointment by the intended parents, usually both members of the couple, always the intended mother. Some intended mothers went to every single blood test with the surrogate. They spoke to each other nearly every day, or depending on how much they wanted to talk to each other, at least once a week, but there was an expectation of continuous contact. Texting all the time, how are you doing, how's the baby, how's that, you know, how is it going? So what I want to say is that the Israeli model puts human relationships at the center of surrogacy and makes surrogacy into a story of connecting and of shared holding of the pregnancy. So what connects between the surrogate and intended mother, first of all, is what Daphna talked about yesterday, this idea that motherhood is the ultimate status of a woman in Israel still, and it's a place where being child-free by choice is still seen as not a really good option, that people will say, no, how could you choose to not have a child? So the women in my study, all of these intended mothers, either they didn't have a womb, or if they, or they were medically in need of surrogacy, or they'd done IVF at least 8 times, some 26 times, a lot of them 17 times, two of them 30 times, and this is IVF for over 17 years of their life. So they really wanted a baby. They really wanted to be a mother. So surrogacy, in this context, there's no question about it in the surrogate's eyes that they understand that what they are doing is the biggest mitzvah or good deed that can be done within this Jewish-Israeli pronatalist society. And really, what's going on here is that surrogates are receiving payment, but they don't have any qualms about the fact that they're receiving payment because it doesn't nullify the mitzvah, the good deed. And surrogates aren't keeping a secret about it. They're telling everyone they know, I'm a surrogate, and here I'm pregnant, and it's not my baby. And usually they get some strange looks or strange questions, but a lot of them, after they explain what they're doing, they get, wow, that's amazing. Good for you. I wish I could do such a thing. Surrogates are talking about themselves. Whoops, I skipped a... Surrogates are talking about themselves not as carrying mothers, as the surrogacy law calls them. They're calling themselves innkeepers, which is the popular term, pundikait in Hebrew, that in the popular press people relate to surrogacy. Surrogates would say, I'm just like an innkeeper. I'm hosting this family. I'm hosting these weary travelers in my body on their way home. I'm holding this baby, and they'd use the word, I'm babysitting, but also I'm guarding and protecting this baby and this family as an innkeeper. So throughout the pregnancy experience, the surrogates would also engage in multiple techniques of delineating the boundaries between the personal self, the personal family, and this family or this baby or this mother they were creating through surrogacy. I call this the body map. And as Delphine spoke of yesterday with Ukrainian and US surrogates, they'd also use these metaphors of I'm just the oven. And we have to remember, I'm an oven, I'm a warm area. I care, but I'm developing something through technology that's not mine. And plus they'd say, I'm the oven who feeds hungry people. In other words, I have the power to feed. And these people are hungry, not like me, who has the oven. So they would say things like, I'm just the innkeeper. I just host the baby. It's not my genes. And I don't develop any feeling for this baby. So they would make these lines on their body of the personal self and the detached belly. And this would start this kind of shared imagining with the intended mothers. the surrogates would start to tell the intended mother, yeah, I feel like this isn't even part of my body. I feel like this pregnancy is alongside me, but not in me. And surrogates would say things to me like, we'd be at a party and they'd say, you see her? I feel like my belly, like this pregnancy, is being held by her. It's like here in this shared space between us. And they talk about cravings, these stories. A surrogate this summer recently told me, she said, you know, from the moment I became pregnant, I couldn't stand the smell or look of green things. I couldn't look at lettuce, leafy vegetables. And then I found out that the intended mother has this sickness that she can't eat anything green. And then it finally made sense. And she, from the moment I got pregnant, she felt nausea. And wasn't that amazing? So they tell these stories of this connection and this sort of transfer of the pregnancy from one body to the other. So I call this the shifting body, and it starts this type of communication where surrogates, as part of the distancing of the pregnancy, they start to communicate everything to the intended mother. They start saying, I feel a pain in my right side. Do you feel it too? And she'll say, yes. And she'll say, I feel nausea. Do you feel it? And she'll say, yeah, and I feel it too. And they'll start talking about things until the intended mothers start to internalize this message, and they start saying, she made me feel like I was pregnant. Yes, I did feel pregnant. Yes, I did feel like I was also carrying my child. I felt like it was me. And so for the intended mothers, some of them actually would talk about being psychologically pregnant, carrying the pregnancy in their head. And some would talk about physical symptoms, like I carried the pregnancy in my body. Intended mothers would say, I gained, 8 kilos, which is a lot of weight during a non-physical pregnancy. And a lot of these intended mothers, I saw them become, all big. And some would say to me in confidence, I have sensitized nipples. I have aches in my breasts. Some of them would actually pretend to be pregnant, only a very few. They would wear a pregnancy dummy belly costume. But a lot of them would just find all these manifestations of physical pregnancy that they would say, this is proof that I'm really pregnant, that I'm pregnant with my surrogate. And so as this exchange gets stronger and stronger, they would talk about themselves as one body. And surrogates would say, she is me and I am her, and we are one body carrying the pregnancy together. And intended mothers would say, as Dahlia, this intended mother said, I felt that she was carrying my child. She's the closest thing to me, as if we're two halves of one belly that unifies us. So this kind of sharing, a shared holding of the pregnancy, it has to follow a very delicate line. And on the one hand, surrogates, they make this red line, and if the intended mother pushes too far, if she goes past where the surrogate has allocated her and starts to enter her personal space, the surrogate will say, I feel suffocated in my own body. And on the other hand, surrogates whose intended mothers didn't come to every medical appointment and didn't try and share in this shared holding of the pregnancy would say, I can't carry it without her. This is too hard. And one surrogate who gave birth early, I remember sitting with her and I said, why do you think that after you carried, 4 children yourself that you went into early labor with this baby? And she said, well, of course, she didn't help me carry it, so it fell. Now, this discourse of the shared holding in the new interviews, it seems like it's become this expectation of surrogates today in Israel, that the intended parents will visit them and will go through everything with them, especially the intended mother. And surrogates who don't have this, they feel cheated of the experience of surrogacy. They want to do it again because they want that connection. Whereas surrogates who've had that connection often say, you only fall in love once. I'm not going to do it again because I've had this intimacy with the intended mother that I don't think I could achieve again. So the birth becomes the culmination of this experience. And during the birth, usually the intended mother will accompany the surrogate into the birth room, sometimes the intended father. If it's a cesarean, and in roughly 40% of cases it ends up being a cesarean because she's carrying twins, and doctors usually convince them not to have a natural birth. So the surrogate can only have one person accompanying her, and it'll be the intended mother. And the intended mother will invariably sit in the back next to the surrogate. The surrogate will be holding her hand. The surrogate will be focused on the intended mother, on her face. And then they'll have this moment, whether it's a regular birth or a cesarean birth, of shared crying as the baby comes out. And often they'll tell me, yes, even the doctor cried, yes, even the nurse cried, as though this moment of shared crying proves to them, proves to the surrogate that this is real. Now, surrogates often talk about this moment of seeing the face as the ultimate moment where they see this woman transform into a mother. And on these surrogacy forums on Facebook now, they often, as soon as they're done with the pregnancy, they write about this experience of seeing the mother's face. And then other surrogates who maybe had an emergency cesarean, maybe gave birth really quickly and the intended mother didn't get there, they feel again cheated. And they want to do it again. And it's as though their experience didn't count because they didn't achieve that intimacy. And I just want to end with these photos of this surrogate and intended mother had a photo session taken during the 7th month of the pregnancy together with the older child of the intended mother. It's also the cover of my book, this photo. And the intended mother said, I did this for my baby. I wanted him to know when he grows up, we all loved him, even from outside the belly. And right after the surrogate gave birth, she actually got pregnant soon after with her own child. And the next year, soon 9 months later, the intended mother accompanied her again to the birth room, this time to help the surrogate deliver her own baby. And the intended mother said to me, now I feel the circle is closed because now I was there just for her. So if we're talking about global surrogacy and we're talking about all these disconnections and all this feeling when I heard Sheila talk and when I heard you talk, I feel like surrogacy can be such a moral nightmare. And I want to say that this law is very paternalistic. I've written a lot about how this is a heteronormative, paternalistic law in Israel that so tightly regulates women's bodies. But I want to suggest that just maybe, in this case, a paternalistic law makes a more human surrogacy. That maybe a paternalistic, very strongly regulated surrogacy humanizes it and it becomes a more ethical and moral surrogacy. So that's a question I'm leaving to you.
Donc merci Ellie. Maintenant on va écouter Lucy Blake qui fait partie de l'université de Cambridge. Je vous en ai parlé hier dans l'introduction. C'est une étude sur le long terme de la gestation pour autrui au Royaume-Uni.
Hi everyone, it's a real pleasure to be here today and part of such a fantastic panel. A hard, tough act to follow, thank you for your brilliant presentations and for a really international and interdisciplinary conference, so it's a real pleasure to be here. We've been to India and Israel and now I'm taking you back to cold and rainy UK. My colleague Fasanti did a wonderful job of outlining surrogacy in the UK for me. She presented a study of surrogates and surrogates' families, and I'm going to be presenting a longitudinal study of the families that are created through surrogacy. And this study has followed up children born through surrogacy from age 1 to age 14. So this study was developed and initiated by Professor Susan Golombok at the Centre for Family Research. And Vasanti has worked on the study for its entirety, and I've worked on it for the past 10 years. So to go back to the roots of the study, to go back 14 years ago, these are the kinds of concerns that were around about surrogacy at that time, and I think they're still around today. So there's concerns that for mothers who conceive through surrogacy, that they don't have the opportunity to bond with their child through pregnancy, and that this might have a negative impact on the relationship between the mother and the child over time. There's concern that the involvement of a third party, so the involvement of a surrogate and the surrogate's family, might interfere with parenting, so that mothers and fathers in the families that result from surrogacy might feel insecure in their parenting role. There's been concern that the surrogate may remain in contact with the family as the child grows up, and that this might be confusing for children and it might be confusing for parents. And there's also been concern about general stigma. So when parents explain that they have started their family through surrogacy, they'll receive disapproval from those around them. Lastly, there's concern about how the children in these families will feel about the way that they were conceived. So this longitudinal study is really being conducted from the perspective of developmental psychology, and the main focus has been on children's well-being. So what is there a potential psychological harm to children that are conceived through surrogacy? Okay. So the sample. So back in 2000, when the study began, we recruited 42 families through surrogacy, and these were recruited through the Office of National Statistics and COTS, which Vasanti talked about in her talk also. We had a control group of 51 families who conceived using egg donation, and another control group of 80 families where parents conceived naturally or through unassisted conception, and they were matched as closely as possible to the assisted reproduction families. So in our sample, most were genetic surrogacy families, and most parents conceived using a surrogate that they hadn't met beforehand. So here are the main research questions we were addressing. So do surrogacy families differ from egg donation or natural conception families with respect to the psychological well-being of parents, so of mothers and fathers, the quality of the relationship between parents and their children, and the psychological adjustment of children? We're also being very interested in talking to the children in these families about how they feel about being born through surrogacy. Other questions were about disclosure. How do parents tell their children about the way that they were conceived? And how does the relationship with the surrogate turn out over time? So as I've said, all children were born at the millennium, and this has been a multi-method study. So we've conducted interviews, observational assessments, and questionnaires, and we've spoken to mothers, fathers, children, and sent questionnaires to the child's teacher. So far, I think we've seen the family 6 times, yet when children were aged 1, 2, and 3, and then we've gone back when they are 7, 10, and just recently finished data collection when they were 14. Okay, so now I'm going to try and summarize 14 years of research in 5 minutes. Is everyone ready? Okay. So at age 1, we compared family functioning in surrogacy families to the natural conception families. We found that mothers and fathers in surrogacy families reported lower levels of parenting stress. They showed lower levels of depression. The fathers in surrogacy families were more satisfied with their parenting role. Mothers and fathers showed greater warmth and sensitivity towards their children and had a greater enjoyment of parenting. And mothers and fathers showed higher levels of emotional involvement with their children. At age 1, we looked at infant temperament, and we found no differences between the 3 family types. Age 2. The surrogacy mothers showed greater pleasure in their children and lower levels of anger, guilt, and disappointment with their children. And surrogacy fathers showed lower levels of parenting stress. When we looked at the children at age 2, we found no differences in children's social, emotional, or cognitive development between the 3 family types. At age 3, the differences that we did find between groups once again reflected greater warmth and greater interaction between surrogacy mothers and their children. So we think these positive findings for the surrogacy families that when their children are aged 1, 2, and 3 is likely a reflection of the fact that the children in these families are very much wanted. So parents have often gone through many years of infertility treatment, and it's perhaps unsurprising that they have so much warmth and enjoyment in parenting given their route to becoming a parent. So we went back to see the families when children were age 7. And this, the kind of questions that we asked at the study, they change over time. So at age 7, children have developed a more sophisticated understanding of inheritance and the meaning of what a biological connection to a parent means. So at age 7, almost all parents had told their children about their surrogacy birth. However, in the genetic surrogacy families, most of the parents had not told their children about the use of the surrogate mother's egg. And by age 10, it was about 50% of parents who had not told their children about the use of the surrogate's egg in their conception. So here's a quote just to demonstrate that kind of partial disclosure that's going on in these families. So we've made it like bread in the oven. So she just kept you warm until you were ready to come out. And so, no, it hasn't come up that biologically she's not mine. At age 7, we found no differences between surrogacy mothers and natural conception mothers on interview assessments of mother-child relationships. And all families showed positive mother-child interaction when we observed mothers playing with their children. In terms of child adjustment, at age 7, the surrogacy children were functioning within the normal range. So on our questionnaires measures, like the strengths and difficulties questionnaire, the children were found to be functioning as in what we would expect for children at that age. However, compared to the children in our other family types, they did show raised levels of adjustment difficulties. And this finding is very similar to internationally adopted children at age 7. And that kind of difference is attributed to the need to deal with identity issues at an early age. By age 10, the raised levels of difficulties of the surrogacy children at age 7 had disappeared. And the same is true of internationally adopted children, whose difficulties also decline at adolescence. So at age 14, our most recent phase of which we've just been analysing and submitting papers, the kinds of questions we asked were slightly different again. Adolescence is a time when issues about identity and autonomy become salient, and that conflict between parents and children is more likely to arise. And adolescence presents specific challenges for adoptive children in terms of identity and adjustment. And adolescence presents specific challenges for adoptive parents in terms of conflict and communication about adoption. So at age 14, we found more positive mother-child relationships in surrogacy families. And this finding is from both mother reports of their relationship and from the teenager's perspective also. And we showed that adolescents born through surrogacy show high levels of psychological adjustment. Parents generally report a more positive relationship with the surrogate from pregnancy to age 10, and that the frequency of contact with the surrogate over time declined. But for the families in our study, when children were age 10, 60% were still in touch with the surrogate, and parents were most likely to have lost contact with previously unknown genetic surrogates. So hopefully I have time. I just want to talk about children's views. We spoke to the children in these families when they were age 7 and again at age 10. Most of the children who were in contact with their surrogate said that they liked her and they described her as being nice and kind. 2/3 wished that they could see her more often, and the remainder felt that the level of contact between them was just right, with just one child wishing they could see her less. So in spite of concerns that children would be distressed by the knowledge that they've been born through surrogacy, we found that most children at this age have neutral or indifferent feelings about their surrogacy origins. And here are some quotes to illustrate this indifference or neutrality. She was really kind about carrying me in her tummy. I think she's kind and she's lovely and funny. I feel fine. I don't feel bad or cross in any way. It's just pretty much nature, so I can't do anything about it. I wouldn't like to do anything about it. And here are children's thoughts and feelings at age 14. I don't really mind. It doesn't affect my daily life. Fine, just normal. I know it's like different, but I don't get like emotional or anything. It's just like talking about anything else. And I don't really care, to be honest. I felt special and quite privileged, really. And I quite like talking about it because it's an interesting fact about me. So there are obviously some limitations to the study, and one of those is our fairly modest sample size in terms of the statistical power. It's also quite rare to see studies in developmental psychology that run for 14 years, and that's because it's so difficult to keep to maintain sample size over time. But what we have found is a sample that over the 14 years, we have roughly 80% of the families still participating when children were 14. But you can't rule out the fact that it could be that the most well-functioning families are the ones that still take part over all those times, and that families with problems might be dropping out. We don't know. A real strength of the study, I think, is the infancy to adolescence perspective, and also the fact that it's an in-depth, multi-method and multi-informant approach. So the conclusion would be that the surrogacy families in this study were well-functioning and that parents were loving and committed, and that surrogacy is not undertaken lightly and couples are willing to accept a third party into the process of forming a family. Children show positive psychological well-being, and that this is the first study worldwide to investigate parenting and child development in surrogacy families. It is a study of UK domestic surrogacy arrangements, so in the context of this conference, the data almost seems to me, if I'm being glib or flippant, quite old-fashioned surrogacy in some ways. And it's important that studies like this are replicated, and that children are followed up to adolescence and beyond. There is a lot more work to be done. From a developmental psychology approach, this research fits nicely into a narrative that is developing where family structure matters less for children's psychological well-being than the quality of family relationships. So positive family relationships are more influential than whether or not children lack a genetic or a gestational relationship with their parents. So these are very wanted children whose parents went to great lengths to have them. Thank you.